Money Psychology. Money Psychology.
Every time you reach for your wallet, check your bank balance, or make a financial decision, you're not just dealing with money. You're reliving every money lesson, fear, and belief you absorbed before you were old enough to understand what any of it meant. I'm Elliot Graves, and this is Money Psychology, where we explore how your earliest financial experiences created the money mindset that controls your financial life today. Welcome to Money Psychology. Money Psychology. Have you ever stopped to think about how much of your financial story is written, not just by the numbers in your bank account, but by the very core of who you are? It's a powerful question. For me, this topic is, well, it's personal. I've seen firsthand, in my own life and in my community, how the journey of self-acceptance and the fight for basic rights creates this entirely different financial roadmap. It's a path that isn't taught in schools or discussed at the family dinner table. Exactly. And for me, my interest really sparked from watching close friends navigate this. I started noticing these invisible hurdles and unique pressures they faced that I'd never even had to consider. It made me realize there's a whole dimension to financial psychology that we just don't talk about enough. A dimension shaped by societal attitudes, by discrimination, by the very act of building a life and a family in a world that hasn't always made space for you. There are so many layers to this, and that's exactly what we're peeling back today. We're diving deep into a conversation that is so incredibly important and long overdue. We're calling this episode The Financial Spectrum: Decoding the Impact of LGBTQ+ Identity on Money Behavior. We're going to explore those hidden scripts, the personal stories, and the research to really understand how these unique life experiences shape the financial landscape for LGBTQ+ individuals. This is going to be a revealing conversation. It really is. We're so glad you're here to join us for it. And when you talk about those hidden scripts, it's not just, you know, family attitudes. It goes so much deeper. I was looking at some of the historical context, and it's staggering. We're talking about law codes from the Middle Assyrian Empire, literally 1,000 years BC, with punishments like turning a man into a eunuch for having a relationship with a fellow soldier. It's brutal, and it establishes this foundation, this ancient precedent, that certain relationships are not just socially unacceptable, but criminally punishable in the most visceral way. Exactly. It's not a modern prejudice. It's something that has been codified legally for millennia. Even in ancient Rome, which we sometimes think of as being more open, the laws were incredibly specific about who was an acceptable partner. It was all about power and status. A citizen's body was off limits, but a slave, a prostitute, their bodies were essentially fair game, which creates a direct link between social status and physical safety, a link that has profound economic implications. If your personhood isn't legally protected, how can your property or your financial future be? It can't. And that's the thread that runs through history. But what really struck me, and what has a much more direct impact on the world today, is the legacy of the British Empire. Oh, Section 377. Section 377. One law, introduced in 1861, that criminalized acts against the order of nature. And suddenly, this one colonial power exported its morality code across the globe. And it's still on the books in dozens of former colonies. Think about that. More than half the countries that criminalize homosexuality are part of the Commonwealth. It's a direct colonial inheritance. It's a virus in the legal code, and the language itself, against the order of nature. Forget the legal penalties for a moment. What does that do to a person's psyche? If the law of your land tells you that who you love is fundamentally unnatural, how do you build a financial plan? How do you save for a future that the state itself deems disordered? The very concept of long-term planning, retirement, inheritance, joint ownership, is predicated on the idea of a stable, recognized future. But these laws actively deny that possibility. It's not just a hurdle. It's a foundational crack in the ability to even imagine a secure financial life. And it wasn't always this way in many of those places. The text points out that in the Indic cultural sphere, there were concepts of a third sex in religious texts. In the Kama Sutra, the Hijra community, for example, had a place. Then the British arrived and labeled them an outlaw tribe. They were literally reclassified under the Criminal Tribes Act. So you take a community that had a social and economic role, and overnight, you turn them into criminals. You strip them of their ability to own property, to work, even to have children. That is a direct, state-sanctioned destruction of generational wealth. It's economic violence, cloaked in the language of morality. It is. And that history isn't just in the past. It creates a present-day reality where in many countries, you can be fired, denied housing, or refused a loan simply for who you are. The psychological weight of that history is immense, but the practical, economic consequences are devastatingly real and continue to this day. And that phrase, devastatingly real, that's what lands for me, because it's not history. We're talking about a world right now where your ability to build wealth, to be safe, to even exist without fear, is determined by which side of a border you happen to be born on. It's a complete lottery. It's a legal and financial mosaic, isn't it? You look at South America, for example, who have Argentina, which has had marriage equality since 2010. Comprehensive gender identity laws, a real leader.
Right.
A place where the legal framework supports building a future. And then you look right next door at Paraguay, and you see a constitutional ban on same-sex unions. Or you look at Guyana, where male homosexuality can still theoretically land you a life sentence. The whiplash? It's staggering. The psychological whiplash. Imagine the mindset that creates. How can you plan for a 5-year, 10-year, 20-year future when the country a few hundred miles away views your existence as a life in prison offense? That instability, that ambient threat, has to seep into every financial decision you make. It absolutely does. It shortens your time horizon. Saving for retirement feels almost absurd when basic legal recognition isn't even guaranteed. The focus becomes immediate security, not long-term wealth building. And it's not just a simple switch of legal versus illegal. That's what's so insidious. There are all these tiers of acceptance. You see it all over the data.
Yeah. What do you mean by that?
Well, a country might decriminalize same-sex acts. That's step one. A huge step, don't get me wrong. But then, nothing else. No recognition of relationships, no joint adoption, and crucially, no anti-discrimination laws in housing or employment. Ah, so it's the you're not a criminal, but you have no rights model. Exactly. It's a legal purgatory. The state says, we won't put you in jail for who you love, but it also says, we won't stop your landlord from evicting you or your boss from firing you for that same reason. So, how do you sign a lease with a partner? How do you apply for a mortgage together? The answer is, you can't. Not with any real security. Every major financial milestone that builds stability and generational wealth, homeownership, joint bank accounts, inheritance, is built on a foundation of legal recognition that simply isn't there. You're building a financial house on sand, and you're constantly aware that a single wave, a prejudiced employer, a homophobic landlord, a medical emergency where you can't make decisions for your partner, could wash it all away. And a medical emergency is a perfect example. We see places that might have some limited recognition, maybe for hospital visitation rights. But that same partnership isn't recognized for tax purposes or for inheriting property without a massive tax penalty. It's a selective recognition that only kicks in during a crisis,
which is so psychologically damaging.
It tells you your relationship is only valid in the context of tragedy. Think about the financial cost of that alone, the amount of money same-sex couples have to spend on lawyers, on drafting wills, medical directives, powers of attorney, all to try and replicate a fraction of the protections that are just automatically granted to different sex couples the moment they marry. It's a tax, a literal and emotional tax on your identity.
It is. A tax paid in legal fees, in higher insurance premiums, and in the constant low-grade stress of knowing your safety net is something you had to stitch together yourself, and it could still be torn apart by a single unsympathetic judge. And that cognitive load, it's a form of debt, isn't it? It's not on a balance sheet, but you pay interest on it every single day with your mental energy, your focus, your ability to take risks. How much creative or entrepreneurial energy is lost, globally, just to the simple act of navigating a world that refuses to fully acknowledge you? That's a profound way to put it. It's an invisible drag on economic potential. But it also makes the counterexamples, the places that have moved towards recognition, so much more illuminating. You look at the data from countries like Spain or the Netherlands, which were early to legalize marriage, and you see a tangible economic shift.
Right. It's not just a symbolic victory. It's a financial tool. It is. Suddenly you have a surge in joint homeownership. You see more efficient tax planning, easier transfer of assets, access to spousal benefits. All these mechanisms for building and protecting wealth that were previously off limits suddenly become available. The playing field doesn't become perfectly level overnight, but a massive, systemic barrier is just removed. I think for me, the biggest shift is psychological. It's the move from a defensive financial posture to an aspirational one. You go from, how do I protect what I have from being taken away, to what can we build together for the future? That is a monumental change in mindset. It's the difference between planning for survival and planning for a legacy. And that's where my final thoughts kind of land. The data is clear. Legal recognition is a powerful economic accelerant. But it's not a panacea. Even in the most progressive countries, you still see significant disparities, especially for transgender individuals.
Oh, without a doubt, the fight for legal recognition of one's gender, the financial costs of transition, the rampant employment discrimination, that's a whole other layer of this financial house of sand we were talking about.
Exactly. So while we can celebrate the progress on marriage and partnership rights, it feels like the next frontier is ensuring that economic inclusion extends to everyone on the spectrum. That's the lingering question for me. How do we move from legal recognition to genuine economic equity? And I think my final takeaway is a little different, maybe more foundational. It's that this entire conversation proves that you can't separate financial health from human rights. They are inextricably linked. A society that grants dignity and safety to all its citizens is, by definition, creating a more prosperous and stable economy for everyone.
The ultimate win-win. It's not a zero-sum game. Not at all. When you give people the security to plan, to invest, to build, they do. It's that simple. This hasn't just been a conversation about money. It's been about the fundamental right to imagine and build a future. And that has been, well, it's been incredibly powerful to sit with.
It really has. A huge thank you to everyone who has listened and joined us for this vital conversation on money psychology. The next time you make a financial decision that surprises you, whether it's an impulsive purchase or an overly cautious investment choice, ask yourself, whose voice am I hearing, and what childhood memory might be driving this choice? Understanding your money psychology doesn't guarantee better financial decisions, but it's the first step toward making choices based on your current reality rather than your childhood fears and dreams.